Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Hello everyone, my name is Helen Lewis, I'm a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, and it's my great joy and pleasure to be interviewing Nir Eyle, who is the author of this book. I've got a proof copy, but it is in the branded yellow. You mentioned in the book that you've got a yellow book, so it's quite easy to find in bookstores. Well done on that one. I hope you'll get stuck in and let us know what you think, because today's event is part of a series of RSA talks that want to build a new public conversation about the relationship between tech and society. In an age where lots of us are concerned that our devices are doing us more harm than good, how can we start to develop and deploy new technologies in a more human-centred and fulfilling way? How can we ensure that tech serves us rather than enslaves us? So, Nir is the perfect person to talk to about this. How many years ago was it now? 5 years ago, your first book, Hooked, was about how you can build habit-forming products. So I kind of slightly see you as a bit of a kind of slight poacher-turned-gamekeeper in this one. So the new book is about how to stop yourself being distracted by your gadgets, how to maybe break bad habits, how to reclaim your time. And Nir's going to take us through some of the findings for the book so far. So shall I hand over to you first, and then we'll come back and have a conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. It's quite an honor to be here today. I appreciate you coming. Today, you know, I want to talk about for a minute about what we've all seen, which is this increased in distractibility that we've all noticed over the past few years. We go to a meeting with our colleagues and we see that half the people around the table are distracted by their devices and are not really fully present with us. We sit down at our desks to work on a big project and yet find ourselves checking email or scrolling a Slack channel or doing something else rather than the thing we planned to do with our time. What is going on here? And is it really technology that is to blame? Or is there something deeper going on? A few years ago, I wrote a book called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And I wrote this book in order to expose and share these tactics that many of the world's biggest, most successful companies use to keep us hooked. Companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp and Slack. I wanted to understand and share the deeper psychology behind how these products are built. Not for the benefit of those companies. They have known these techniques for years. I wanted to share these techniques so that all sorts of businesses could use these very same psychological principles to help people build healthy habits in their lives. And that's exactly what's happened over the past 5 years. Companies like Kahoot get kids hooked to in-classroom learning. Fitbod gets people hooked to exercising in the gym. Byte Foods gets people hooked to healthier food options. So, Hooked has had a fantastic impact. I'm still proud of that work and still encourage companies to build the kind of products and services that can build healthy habits in users' lives. But of course, there's also a flip side. That when we design products to be engaging, sometimes some products with some people are overused and can become distracting. And in fact, in my own life, after I wrote Hooked 5 years ago, very shortly thereafter, I was sitting with my daughter and we had an afternoon together. And we had this book of activities that daddies and daughters could use to kind of get closer to one another. One of the activities in this book was to ask each other this question. If you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And I remember this question verbatim, but I can't tell you what my daughter said. Because you see, in that moment, I had become distracted by my device, and I wasn't paying attention to my daughter. She got the message that whatever was on my phone was more important than she was, and she left the room to play with some toy outside. I told this story to a friend of mine recently, and he asked the same question to his daughter. And when he asked his daughter, what superpower would you want? She told him she wanted the power to talk to animals. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Why would you want the power to talk to animals? And she said, so that when you and mommy are on your phones, I'll have someone to talk to. Heartbreaking, right? And so it's instances like this that really prodded me to understand the deeper cause of distraction. And what I learned is that distraction, it turns out, is not a new problem. That in fact, Plato talked about the problem of distraction 2,500 years ago. He called it akrasia, this tendency that we all have to do things against our better interests. And it's a fascinating question, I think. Why is it that despite knowing what to do, we don't do the things we know we should? We know we should exercise, we don't. We know we should eat better, we don't. We know we should work on that big project and we procrastinate. Why don't we do the things we know we should? And so in order to understand this fundamental question, I think we have to start by understanding what do we mean when we use this term distraction. The best way to understand what distraction is to understand what distraction is not. The opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction turns out to be traction. If you look at the etymology of the word, traction and distraction both come from the same Latin root, meaning from the root trahare, which means to pull. And you'll notice that both words end in the same six letters. They both end in A-C-T-I-O-N, action. So traction is any action that pulls us towards what we want to do, things that we do with intent. Now, the opposite of traction is distraction, anything we do that pulls us away from what we plan to do, things that we do without intent. Now, this is important for a few reasons. One, I think it frees us from this ridiculous moral hierarchy that what I do with my time is fine, but with what you do with your time, that's frivolous. So you spending time on Facebook or Candy Crush, no, that's a waste of time, but me watching football for 3 hours, that's okay. Why? If they're done with intent, if these are things that are consistent with your values that you plan to do with your time, they're both perfectly fine pastimes. The other thing that's important about this dichotomy is that we can realize that anything can become a distraction. For example, in my case, I would sit down at my desk and I would promise myself that now I'm going to get to work. Now I'm going to do that thing that I'm procrastinating on. I'm going to finally do what it is I said I'm going to do. Right after I check email. Right after I scroll that Slack channel. And something that felt worky, it felt like something I needed to do anyway for my work, right? We all have to check email. That's just part of our jobs. However, if it's not what you plan to do with your time, if it's something that you are not doing with intent, it is just as much of a distraction. So the next question is, why are we prompted to either do actions that take us towards traction or distraction? Well, there are two things that prompt us to take these actions. The first are what we call the external triggers. External triggers are things in our environment that prompt us to either traction or distraction. So if an external trigger, like a ping, a ding, a ring, a notification, even a colleague, prompts you to do something you plan to do with your time, it's leading you towards traction. However, if one of these notifications takes you off track, prompts you to do something you didn't plan to do, as it was the case when I was with my daughter, when my phone buzzed and I was on my device as opposed to being present with her, it led me towards distraction. However, as much as we blame these external triggers, it turns out the most common source of distraction are not the things outside of us, but rather the fact that distraction tends to start from within us. These are what we call the internal triggers. Internal triggers are these uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape from. And so if we're going to answer Plato's question of why do we do things against our better interests, we have to start a layer deeper. We have to start with the question of why do we do anything and everything? Most people, if you ask them, why do people do what they do? What's the fundamental nature of human motivation? They'll give you some version of carrots and sticks. This is called Freud's pleasure principle, that everything we do is about the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. But neurologically speaking, that is not true. That in fact, what we now know is that everything that we do for one reason, and that is to escape from discomfort. We know this to be true physiologically. If you think about it, if you go outside and it's cold, you put on a coat. And if it's hot, once you walk back inside, you take it off. If you're hungry, you feel hunger pangs, you eat. And when you're stuffed, you've eaten too much, that doesn't feel good, you stop eating. So these are physiological sensations that prompt us towards action. The same rule applies to psychological discomfort. So let me ask the audience, what website or app do people check when they're feeling lonely? Where do we go? Facebook. Somebody said Tinder? Also true, different kind of loneliness, but also true. What about when we're feeling uncertain? Where do we go? We go to Google. If we're feeling uncertain, before we scan our brains to see if we know the answer, we're already Googling it. And what about when we're feeling bored? Where do we go when we're feeling bored? We check YouTube, we look at Reddit, we look at stock prices, sports scores, Pinterest, all of these products and services cater to this uncomfortable emotional itch, this feeling that we don't want to experience. Therefore, if we conclude that all behavior is prompted by a desire to escape discomfort. That means that time management is pain management. That the latest life hacks and gurus techniques don't work unless we fundamentally understand this fact that time management is pain management. If we do not deal with the reason why we are looking for escape, why we are getting distracted in the first place, why we want to take our mind off of this emotional discomfort, we will never escape distraction. So we really only have two choices when it comes to mastering these internal triggers. We can either solve the source of the problem, whether that's trouble at home, whether that's a dysfunctional workplace culture, these fundamental problems that cause this discomfort, or for the discomforts of life that we can't necessarily fix, we have to learn methods to cope with discomfort. So the first step has to be to master these internal triggers. And there's all kinds of ways that I describe in the book on how we can use these tactics to cope with discomfort so that it leads us towards traction rather than distraction. We can get into that a little later as well. The second step to becoming indistractable is to make time for traction. You know, one of the things I realized as I researched my book over the past 5 years is the remarkable number of people who do not keep a calendar. 2/3 of Americans do not keep any sort of a schedule. Think about how much time and effort we spend keeping our stuff safe. We have home security systems, we have alarms on our cars, we keep our money safe in a bank somewhere. We spend a lot of effort protecting our stuff. But when it comes to our time, we let anybody come in and steal it away from us. And I think that's a fundamental mistake. In this day and age, if you don't plan your time, somebody is going to plan it for you. And the fact of the matter is, we cannot call something a distraction unless we know what it distracted us from. And so that means what I suggest to folks, what I started to do that changed my life, was to use this technique called making an implementation intention. This technique has been studied in thousands of separate studies, and it's found that this technique, which is very simply planning out what you are going to do and when you are going to do it, is an incredibly impactful way to make sure that you stay on task, that you get more traction in your life versus distraction. Because the first time I was able to look at my calendar and say, oh, these tasks is what I plan to do, that is traction. Anything else is a distraction. This revolutionized my work life. It changed my marriage completely. One instance that I found that was troubling me in my marriage, when my wife and I have been married for 18 years. And several years ago, before I finished this book, we would constantly fight about household responsibilities. And my wife would implore me to, you know, do more stuff around the house. And I would always ask her, I would say, I'm not a mind reader. If you want me to do something, just tell me what to do, right? And it turns out that the research shows that I'm part of the majority here, that in fact, in dual-income heterosexual marriages, in most households, women take on a disproportionate share of the household admin duties. I see a lot of women nodding their heads. No men are agreeing with me here. And I was guilty of this because one of my values was to be in an equitable marriage, right? Where one of my values is to pull my weight. And I wasn't doing that. Why wasn't I doing that? Because it wasn't clear what my responsibilities were and when I would do them. So now every week, my wife and I sit down and we do what's called a schedule sync. We look at each other's schedules. We have them time boxed, so we know each other's schedules. We look at when we are going to do the tasks of the week. And this has completely saved our marriage. So we can do this at work. We can have a schedule sync with our boss to make sure that we're on the same page around how we are going to spend our time, what priorities matter, which priorities don't matter. This is a very, very important technique, turning our values into time. The third way to become indistractable, the third step, is to hack back our external triggers. Now, I use the term hack back because we all know that technology is designed to hack our attention. I can tell you as an industry insider, that's how it works. And frankly, we want these products to do this. We want products to be engaging, right? Do we want to tell Netflix, please make your shows less interesting? Apple, can you please make your iPhone less user-friendly? I want to use it all the time, and that's not good. No, we can't hold our breaths waiting for these companies to change. If we hold our breath waiting for them to change, we're going to suffocate. So the good news is we can hack back, and there's nothing they can do about it. 2/3 of people with a smartphone never change their notification settings. Can we really say that technology is addicting us, that it's hijacking our brains, when we haven't taken 10 minutes to change our notification settings so that we're not constantly interrupted by all these pings and dings? It takes minutes. So of course, that's kindergarten stuff, hacking back our phones, hacking back our computers so that they're not these hotbeds of distraction. But it turns out, again, technology is not the ultimate source of distraction. It's the symptom, not the cause. And there are all these other distractions that we don't consider that turn out to be just as pernicious, if not more so, than our devices. For example, take the open floor plan office. Many of us today work in these open floor plan offices that are a hotbed of distraction. A colleague coming by and tapping you on the shoulder and, you know, sharing some office gossip, this can take you off track and derail you from what you plan to do with your time. So what's the solution to this? In every copy of Indistractable, I give you a screen sign. It's a piece of cardstock you pull out of the book, you fold it into thirds, and you put it on your computer monitor. And this tells your colleagues, I'm indistractable at the moment, please come back later. So we can hack back, of course, our devices, our office settings, group chat, meetings, email. We can hack back these technologies and these environments to make sure that we get the best out of these tools without letting them get the best of us. And finally, the fourth step to becoming indistractable is to prevent distractions with pacts. Pacts are a pre-commitment device. And this has been studied many times in the psychology community. This is a method of preventing oneself from getting distracted by making some kind of promise, some kind of a pact with ourselves or with someone else. So we can make what's called an effort pact, a price pact, or an identity pact. Let me give you one example. So several years ago, my wife and I found that we were going to bed later and later every night. And this was affecting our sleep, it was affecting our marriage, it was not healthy for us. So what did we do? We went to the hardware store and we bought ourselves an outlet timer. This outlet timer turns off whatever's plugged into it at a certain time of day or night. What did we plug into the outlet timer? Our internet router. So every night at 10 p.m. in my household, the internet shuts off. Now, could I turn it back on? Of course I could. I could go fumble with electronics and unplug it and replug it in. But now I've added some effort to this otherwise effortless behavior of going online. Now I'm mindful as opposed to using the internet mindlessly. Today, this was several years ago, today you can actually buy internet routers that are built in with this capability. So I can leave the smart devices on while turning the distracting devices off at a certain time of day or night. And so this is what we start seeing, is that in fact, part of the solution to the problem of tech distraction, ironically, is more tech. And it seems ironic, but of course this is what has always happened. The philosopher Paul Virilio said that when we invent the ship, we invent the shipwreck. Now, when was the last time you heard of a shipwreck? Very rare. Why did that happen? Did we stop using ships? Of course not. We built better ships that fail less often. And that's exactly what we see today with our technology. We can actually use tech to block out tech distraction. So, in conclusion, the message I want to leave with you today is that I believe that we all can become indistractable. That, in fact, when I sat down with my daughter in finishing my book, I asked her the very same question. I said, look, the first time I asked you what superpower you would want, I wasn't listening. I was distracted. So let me ask you again. If you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And here's what she told me. Honest to goodness, this is what she said. She said that she would want the power to always be kind. That's what she said. I wiped my tear. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized we all have the power to be kind, don't we? We can all choose to be more kind. And the same goes for becoming indistractable. Because this idea that there's nothing we can do about technology, that it's hijacking our brain, that it's addicting everyone, just isn't true. There is so much we can do. We can master those internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back the external triggers, and reduce distractions with pacts. And so, given this fact that we can all be more kind, we can all become indistractable, I really believe that every one of us can get the best out of these tools without letting them get the best of us. We can all become indistractable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by saying I very much enjoyed the book, but all the way through, I had a philosophical disagreement with you, so I want to thrash this out now. Sure. I think where you see individual problems, I see political problems. And I think that, to me, is the most interesting dichotomy about whether or not you say, you know, if we wait for these companies to change themselves, we'll suffocate. And I think that is, you can either say that's pragmatism or it's despair. So what do you think is the role for regulation in saying perhaps we should build better technology? Like, well, how much is it on that couple? You know, how much is it on Google to look at the way the YouTube recommendation algorithm works? Or is your position just that capitalists going to capitalists, they want as much money and as much of our attention as possible, and we don't have the political tools actually anymore to rein them in?
So this book really tackles this one question of distraction. And in some ways, this question of addiction. Is tech hijacking our brain? And this is part of the many things that are discussed when it comes to the role of technology in society. That's the question I'm focused on. And I'm not a tech apologist. I think that these technology companies have a lot to answer for. Political interference, data mining, monopoly status, lots of things that these companies need to be held account for. But when it comes to this particular problem, this is my swim lane, right, of making products more engaging, and can we use that for good, and are some products addictive or hijacking our brain? That's where I feel I am qualified to talk about this. And when it comes to this individual challenge, I think what we see happening is that companies are doing something to fix this problem. And clearly, we've seen Apple integrate Screen Time, this product that helps us use their products less. We see Google doing something similar with Google Wellbeing. And why are they doing that? I mean, this is such an odd behavior. Why would a company want to build features into their product to get you to use that product less? And what we see happening is exactly what happened in the automotive industry. Seatbelts were placed in cars 17 years before any legislation mandated it. Why? Because safer cars sell better. And so that's exactly what's going on. That's what Google and Apple are doing today. They are making products that people want to use. And we're not idiots. We're not puppets on a string. We can't manipulate people forever in a way that gets them to use a product they don't want to use. So when people find that a product is something that is harming them, that is not enhancing their lives, they either switch to a different product, they moderate their use, or they stop using the product. And so Apple and Google have an incentive to make the kind of products that people want to use. They took a look at the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, and they saw that there were thousands of products that were helping people moderate their use, so they decided to build that in to give that away to everyone. So I think the tech companies are doing quite a bit. However, and I think they could absolutely do more. The tools are not sufficient. They could definitely improve those. But I think they will never solve the problem completely.
Absolutely.
Because fundamentally, we have a role.
But also that, I mean, I think Apple, as you say, has led the way on that, but that's because Apple's business is essentially a hardware and software business, right? They want to sell physical iPhones, which are, you know, $1,000 each. Google's business is fundamentally an advertising business, and it is an existential threat to them if people spend less time using Google products, right? So their incentives are not in the same place as Apple's on that. I think maybe they find it a harder challenge.
I think it's a bit simplistic. I think if you look at the short term, it would seem, you know, this argument, well, don't these companies want to get us addicted? Don't they want us to use the products all the time? Well, not really, in fact. And I've went to these companies as an unpaid consultant, and I've helped advise them on how they can improve their services. And I can tell you, they sincerely do want to give us tools to moderate our use. Well, why? Because they don't want us to use these products for a little while and then say, I hate these things, and buy a product like the Lite phone that gets rid of all the apps and just makes phone calls. They know that that's a competitive threat. They want us not to use our products a little bit and then burn out. They want us to use their products for the rest of our lives. And so they do have an incentive for us to like our products. That's built into the model.
But I also think the network effects are quite strong here. I'm sure, I don't know, maybe a straw poll of here. How many people in this room would like to not check their email after hours, but feel that they have to for work reasons, right? I think that's probably a reasonable number of people.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And I think it is, the problem is that you might feel like you hate your phone and you hate being constantly on call, which is what a lot of modern knowledge economy jobs are. But you can't unless you want to unilaterally go and live in a yurt.
Yeah.
That you can't escape even a product that you hate.
I'm so glad you brought this up. So we only had time to cover about the backbone for about half the book. Half the book is about what you can do yourself, how you as an individual can become indistractable. The second half of the book acknowledges the fact that we operate in various environments and that our environments shape our behavior. So there's a whole section on how to build an indistractable workplace, how to raise indistractable kids, how to have an indistractable relationship, because environments shape our behavior. And I think you're absolutely correct. If your company culture is a certain way, it can be very hard to not be tied to your phone. But here's the question. If your boss calls you at 8 p.m. on a Friday night and says, I need you to do something right now, is it the phone that's at fault? Is it the technology that enabled your boss to get in touch with you? I would argue it's your boss and your workplace that facilitates the kind of culture where that's acceptable. And what we find, what I found in my research, is that there is no connection between technology use and distraction. In fact, one of the technologies that people complained about most when I surveyed people and talked to folks in my research over the past 5 years, number one most distracting technology was email. Number two was Slack, or some kind of group chat, right? Slack is the largest group chat app, and people just ragged on Slack, how much they hate it, how it ties them to work, and they can never leave work, and it's constantly distracting them. So I went to pay Slack a visit. And I expected, look, if it's technology that is distracting us, well, nobody uses Slack more than the employees of Slack. They should be the most distracted people on Earth. But that's not what I discovered. That in fact, at Slack, if you use Slack after hours or on weekends, you are reprimanded. That is not what we do here. And so what I discovered is that the kind of culture that supports not constantly getting distracted, that fights this always-on company culture, is the kind of company culture that gives people three things. The company culture that gives people psychological safety, it's incredibly important. The ability to raise your hand and voice a concern is a key trait. Two, they give employees a forum to talk about these problems. So interestingly enough, at Slack, they actually use Slack channels. They have a channel called Beef Tweets, where it's all about posting beef about the company, things you don't like. They give employees, they encourage employees to have that channel, and company management acknowledges those issues with, interestingly enough, emoji. They'll use emoji, the eye emoji, the checkmark emoji, to tell employees, yep, we're on that, we're taking care of it. And then third, the most important factor, is a company culture where management exemplifies what it means to be indistractable. That culture flows downhill. Right? So if your boss is always on their device, you have an incentive to always be on your device. And so at Slack, I couldn't believe it. I walked into Slack headquarters, and written in big pink neon letters, there's a picture of it in the book, it says, work hard and go home. It's painted on the company wall. Because at Slack, it is part of their company culture that they believe that people do their best work when they can focus at work and then when they're left alone at home. So the conclusion here is that it's not the tech that is the root cause of the problem. It's the proximate cause. It's the symptom. Distraction at work is a symptom of a dysfunctional company culture. Now, the good news is, and this is a whole section of the book, how do we change that? And there are many, many ways that we can change that. I profiled the Boston Consulting Group, which was my first employer after college. And it was, let me tell you frankly, a very tough place to work. Always on culture, it was 24/7. And they actually have made this dramatic shift. Today, they used to have very high employee turnover, very distracted workplace culture, 24/7, always on, people were miserable. And today they're ranked as one of the best places in America to work on Glassdoor by their very employees. They've made this dramatic transformation, and they did it in a very small scale. They started with just one case team of 8 people implementing some of these tactics, and that spread throughout the organization. But you're absolutely right. There is a cultural component.
Which I think is interesting, because when you talk about those Silicon Valley companies, they are fishing in a small pool for very highly sought after, particularly for engineers, right? If you're kind of a great engineer, you can name your price about where you're going to work. How much incentive is there for companies further down the scale, right, who aren't necessarily desperate to have a high staff retention, to treat their staff well? What are the techniques you use to say to them, this is also going to work for you?
Well, interestingly enough, when a company culture realizes that the real problem with distraction is not the technology, the real problem is that people can't talk about their problems. That's a very important insight. What we found at companies like the Boston Consulting Group is that when they started to talk about the problem of distraction, they realized there were all kinds of other skeletons in the closet. That if people didn't feel psychological safety to raise their hand and express something that all of us feel. Nobody in the company likes, being called in the middle of their kid's basketball game or when they're out to dinner with their spouse. Nobody likes being interrupted like that, even from the boss on down. And so if we can't talk about that problem, that's the real problem. So when companies of any size can talk about this problem in an environment where people feel psychological safety, meaning they can raise this concern without fear of getting fired, they learn all these other secrets that have been kept, all the other unmentionables. And so what we see from the Boeing disaster that recently happened with the 787 MAX to the Enron scandal, there are always people inside the company that don't want to talk about what they're seeing. And that's the real source of the problem, because distraction in the workplace is just another problem among many, many others. But we can't fix that problem if we can't talk about it.
I feel like there has, as you say, you're not a tech evangelist or maybe even not a tech skeptic sitting somewhere kind of in the middle. And it does feel like we had a decade of Facebook's going to save the world, followed by a decade of Facebook's going to destroy the world. Mm-hmm. And maybe we're in a, you know, we'll move to a place where we acknowledge that both of those things can simultaneously be true. But I just wonder, you know, what is your own relationship with tech? I think that line about when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck is really good and really interesting. What for you is the ship? What has a smartphone and all its distractible glory given us? What's the upside of all this technology?
It's interesting you say that. So there's a known cognitive quirk about that comes along with our hardware in our brains, which is called the negativity bias. That it's very hard for us in the moment to see what technology has done for us lately. But go back a few years. Think about what it was like when we were kids. And I could describe to you that today, you could take out of your pocket this device, which will give you a video phone and the world's information at your fingertips and connect you to people all over the world for free or virtually free. I mean, these are miracle devices. But we so quickly adapt, and we only think about the bad stuff. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think we are starting to shift very quickly from a point of view on technology that used to be skeptical. And skepticism is a virtue. I think that's a good trait. I think people in Silicon Valley would tell you that's a defining trait of Silicon Valley is skepticism. But now we are moving towards a point of view of cynicism, that tech can do no right. And I think that is dangerous. We are telling people and we're giving people the message that nothing good can come out of this stuff. And I think that's really dangerous. And even this nature of this question of what has tech done for us lately, so much. I mean, so much. There are lots of downsides, of course. But there is so much upside. I mean, if you think about, you know, the Me Too movement, I believe, could not have happened if people could not congregate together in groups. I mean, that's what the internet really does. It helps disparate people come together into groups. That means that you can join people together around a cause. Sometimes that cause is also unsavory, right? We also get congregations of people that have ends that are not so savory. But this is the shipwreck, right? So that we get along with the ships. But I think overall what we're seeing is that there's a lot of promise ahead. We don't want to be cynical about this stuff. We want to remain skeptical and to create new technologies that fix the last generation of technologies.
On your website, you write, and I think this comes from Hooke, the regret test, right? The idea that if people need to know what the technology is kind of doing to them, and if they still are okay with participating in it, that is a much better and informed decision. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that, because I think that's a really interesting insight.
Yeah, so, you know, people ask if I've considered the ethical side. Well, of course I've considered the like I've been working on this for more than a decade now, and even with the publication of Hooked, I have a whole chapter that's called The Morality of Manipulation. Of course, I've considered this, and so what I wanted was some kind of test, some kind of slogan, some kind of motto that a designer in a company could raise their hand and ask their team to utilize in order to answer this question of, are we using these techniques effectively? Right? Are we using behavioral design in a way that enhances people's lives, that we're doing this ethically? And to steer away from what we call dark patterns. And so I went looking around Silicon Valley, and I wanted a different motto from what Google gave us. Google gave us, don't be evil. And of course, that's not Google's motto anymore, but used to be. But I don't think that's a good motto, because what is evil? I mean, what's evil to you is not going to be evil to me. It's a very subjective term. So that's not a great way to design product. So then I talked to people at an ethics center at a university, and they told me about the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But that's not really great either, because what that assumes is that what I as the designer think I want done to me is what you should want done to you. That's not effective either. We want to do unto others as they want done to themselves. So that's not a good practice. Then I talked to the lawyers, and the lawyers told me, well, just disclose, right? We can legislate it, and we'll make you tell, you know, the government should make people, should make companies disclose everything they're going to do. But that doesn't work either. If we do that, we just get these terms of service agreements that everybody scrolls through and clicks accept, and nobody actually reads. So that's not a good motto either. So what I came up with was the regret test. And the regret test says that in order for us to implement one of these techniques that's questionable, that we're not sure about, that's on the line, designers should be empowered to raise their hand and say, I'd like to run a regret test, which looks like this. We bring in a representative number of users, and we do what we've done for decades in the technology industry. We do what's called a usability test. We bring in a group of users, we show them the experience, and we see where they stumble. And we can also do this in an ethical way, meaning we need to ask them, knowing everything that we now know, right? Everything that I know as a designer, I'm going to divulge to you. I'm going to tell you right here and now what happens when you click this button, what happens in this interaction. Given that you know everything that I as the designer know, would you do what I have designed for you to do? Meaning, do you regret this experience? Because remember, there is two types of manipulation. There is persuasion and there is coercion. Persuasion, I think, is completely ethical, right? We many times submit to persuasion. We like to be manipulated. We pay for the privilege. When we go to see a movie in a movie theater, we know that that's just flickering light. We know that that's not reality, that those are actors on the screen. But we pay for the privilege of having our emotions manipulated. We like being persuaded in that context because that's what we want to do. Coercion is the opposite. Coercion is defined by regret, that we didn't want that thing done to us. And so the regret test is this tool that we can use in a corporate setting to say, you know what, I'm not sure if that pattern is ethical. Can we run a regret test? The good news is that even the threat of a regret test tends to have a chilling effect, right? The threat of, you know what, that's a good point. We can do better. Let's try something else. And so that's a policy I'd like to see implemented more widely.
Before we get to questions, I just want to talk about a couple of the specific things that you talk about in the book. I have to say the schedule I loved. I love an Excel document. I love to plan my holidays in punishing detail. How hard do you find it? Because for those of you who haven't read the book yet, you kind of say, you know, 15 minutes TV time here. Like you can build in, as you say, these things that seem fun or frivolous or whatever, because as long as you're doing them mindfully, you know, you've chosen to do it, you're not just scrolling through the Netflix menu, right, like, you know, for the 15th hour. They're fine, but how hard do you find it to actually stick to the schedule?
So once you make your the purpose of a time box calendar is not to punish yourself, it's not to shame yourself if you fall off track. The purpose is to just be able to understand what is traction and what is distraction, because you can't call something a distraction unless you know what it distracted you from. So for me, I do it in increments of about 30 minutes. I'm not quite so specific about 15 minutes of TV watching, but I will put in time for things that were otherwise distractions. So for example, in my calendar every day, I have time for social media. I love social media. It connects me with my friends. It's entertaining. It's relaxing. I enjoy it, and there's nothing wrong with it. However, by putting time in my calendar to do that, there's two benefits. One, I've taken that the distraction that I used to use throughout my day, and I've turned it into traction. Now it's something I plan to do with intent. The other benefit is that I don't have to constantly think about when am I going to do it. So part of what creates these internal triggers is, ooh, I wonder what's waiting for me on Twitter. I wonder what's on my email account. I wonder what's happening here. I should probably go check soon. By knowing, nope, there is time for it in my day. I have time for email. I have time to check social media. I have time to do these things that were otherwise distractions. The stress that would otherwise prompt me to check all day is extinguished.
So talk me through your phone. Do you have any push notifications on?
I only have push notifications for the things that deserve to reach out to me if it was an emergency. So phone, text, yes. No notifications for any kind of social media.
That's good. When I'm writing, I put my phone onto ringer and then turn it face down on the basis if anyone's dying, they'll phone me, I presume, yeah, right? But apart from that, I really don't need to
know. And there's even now the functionality in the Apple iOS called Do Not Disturb While Driving that you can customize. And so when you turn it on, it's a great feature. Almost nobody uses it. It's wonderful. So when you turn it on, if someone calls or texts you, they'll get an auto reply that says, I'm driving right now. If this is urgent, text me the word urgent. Of course, you don't have to use it only while you're driving. You can use it anytime. And in fact, mine, I've customized, so it says I'm indistractable at the moment. If this is urgent, text the word urgent. And if someone replies with the word urgent, then the message comes through. So it's even better than just waiting for a phone call.
And then you say in the book about keeping your home screen uncluttered. What's on your first screen when you unlock your phone?
Oh, you can see it. I can bring it up, actually, if you want. But it basically says I'll show you. Can we bring up the...
We're going to see some minimalist iPhone homepage here, right?
Can you show the screen?
Wow. Look at that desktop, it's beautiful.
I practice what I preach. And there's actually a lot of data that shows that, you know, I've seen, there's a picture in the book of what my home screen used to look like, of all this cluttered, you know, stuff on our screen. We think, okay, that's no big deal. Or what I used to constantly do, I would open a website, and while that website was loading, open the next tab. You've done this, haven't you, right?
I've done that.
I used to do it with dozens of tabs. And the research shows us that the more of these external triggers that are around us, the more likely we are to become distracted. So this is where we hack back.
So, I definitely do this. You read the email to check that it's not someone saying that you've won a car or, you know, you're going to get a Nobel Prize. And then you go, oh, actually, it's just somebody asking me to, you know, can I reply to them about a meeting on Monday? And therefore don't reply to it.
Right. So email is, again, this was the number one source of distraction when I asked people about technology, which is interesting because it's not, you know, when people talk about how technology is so distracting, we talk about Facebook, which is relatively new, or Pinterest or Twitter or whatever. Nobody talks about email, but really it's not a new technology. It's a 1970s technology, and there's no one company for us to blame and point the finger on. But it turns out to be incredibly distracting. And so one of the techniques I recommend in the book is to label emails by when they need a reply. And the reason this is so important is because what we find is that the time we waste on email is not the checking, it's not the replying, it's the rechecking. Here's what it looks like. You take out your phone, you open the email, you read it, you put it away. You open the next email, you read it, you put it away. 20 minutes later, what did that email say? Let me open it again, read it, put it away. That's where we waste time. And of course, you know, email is the mother of habit-forming technology. It is full of these intermittent rewards and variable, you know, these variable reinforcements. Very, very habit-forming. So what we want to do instead, every time we open an email, we need to scan it for just one question. From a time management perspective, the most important question is, when does this email need a reply? If it never needs a reply, we just delete it. If it needs a reply right this minute, hair on fire type problem, of course you have to reply. That's a tiny percentage of your emails. Most of your emails will fall into two buckets, something that needs a reply today or something that needs a reply this week. So what we do, we label based on those two labels, and then we have time in our time box calendar when we know we will reply to just the emails that are important today. So we reduce our email load from 70 to about 7 emails. It's about 10 to 20% of your emails actually need to be replied to today. And that's the only emails we need to reply to. Then we have time in our time box calendar for all the emails that can wait, things that can get a reply within a week's time. Why is this so important? Aren't we just deferring the inevitable? No. There's a magical thing that happens when we let emails marinate. Many of them no longer require a reply. People figure out their own problems. Something gets crushed under the weight of some other priority. And so you'll slowly see that email load disappear because many of these emails that we think are so urgent that actually if you could just let them wait a little bit can take care of themselves. So the rule to getting fewer emails every day is to send fewer emails in a set period of time. And you do this by only replying to the urgent messages.
Okay, let's go to questions. We'll be able to get microphones to you in the audience, so do wait for one to come to you. I'll take one over there, and then if you can pass your microphone on afterwards, that'd be great.
Hi, my name's Esme. So I really love what you said at the start about not having a moral judgment about it, but I'm sitting here thinking, how do you create time in your schedule for the idle and for the exploratory and for the serendipitous, which in some ways has to be unplanned?
And would you pass the mic over? We'll just take two at a time.
Hi, thanks. My question is actually quite a similar one. I mean, distraction has been getting a good kicking today. I'd like to speak in defense of distraction. In some ways, it's even a survival technique. You know, right. If you're at work and you hear the fire alarm go off, then that's a distraction, but you know, you'd be foolish to ignore it. And even the trivial distractions, you know, the colleague coming by with a piece of gossip, that's actually one of the perks of office work very often. You know, people who work from home often say that they miss that kind of interaction. But distraction is it can trigger imagination. To eliminate distraction, life without distraction would be very dull, I think.
That's great. I think it's interesting because I think the point is that, you know, bosses do have offices for a reason, right? They're putting a limit on the amount of distraction they can get, and a closed door means they can't, which you can't do in an open plan office. But the bigger question, I guess, is how do you still retain some... The time boxing is incredible, but does it make life a little bit rigid?
So I am anti-distraction, but I am pro-diversion. A diversion is when we just focus our attention to something. And it's okay to focus our attention to something that is fun. I'm not saying you have to schedule only productivity, If you want to schedule time to daydream, to pray, to meditate, to journal, to leave time for what I call planned spontaneity, great, do it. There's nothing wrong with planning that time as well. But here's the thing. You know, perfect is the enemy of the good. And when people say, oh, this technique, I don't know, it's too rigid, it's too that, it's too this, we have to make a trade-off here. In that without planning some of the time in your day, some kind of prioritization in terms of the things that are important to you to help you live out your values. And by the way, I'm not saying what your values should be. I'm saying that if you value these aspects of your life, you have to put them in your calendar. So if physical health is important to you, you're not going to work out improvisationally. It's not just going to happen. You have to plan time for that. Planning time with our friends. How many times have we told somebody, oh, we should really get coffee together? Come on. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen if we don't make time for it. And what we are suffering through the consequences right now of this. You know, we know that there's this loneliness epidemic happening, certainly in my country. I'm not sure exactly what's happening in the UK. Part of why this is happening is with the decline of these civic organizations. And this is not a trend that happened just with social media. This is happening back in the 1990s. Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone, fantastic book, talked about this problem of the decline of these civic groups. Bowling clubs and Kiwanis and church groups, you know, with increasing secularization, people don't have the regular time on their schedule to get together with people who love them and who they love back. And so this is coming at a severe cost. Of course, you know, what do we do when we feel more lonely? Well, we turn to our devices to try and replace that. But of course, social media is not the root cause, and social media is not a replacement for real world contact. It's a supplement to. The real source of the problem is that we don't make time for important people in our life. I met my wife in college, and we took an economics class together. And I remember there was this term that we learned called the residual beneficiary. The residual beneficiary is the chump who gets whatever is left over when a company is liquidated. So first debt holders get their due, then equity holders, then the residual beneficiaries, whoever gets, you know, the penny on the dollar, whatever's left over. A few years ago, my wife turns to me and says, "Nir, you've made me the residual beneficiary." Because work comes first, your friends come first, your writing comes first, and I just get whatever's left over. And we were typically ships in the night. And so, yes, do we want spontaneity? But unless you are fully retired and you really don't have any other priorities in your life to take care of, which is not the situation that most people find themselves in, I certainly didn't, it requires us to plan. You know, part of the cost in living in this amazing century where we have these incredible tech tools and we don't have to go hunt our own food and chop our own wood. Sorry, I'm asking you to make a calendar. I don't think that's all that difficult. I think that's worth the trade-off. And of course, we can plan big swaths of time in our day to be spontaneous, to do things with our friends. Maybe you get together every couple weeks with the same group of friends, and what you do with that time is totally up to you, right? So you can actually, in a way, it sounds like an oxymoron, you can actually plan for that spontaneity. But if you don't plan for it, there's no way it's going to happen.
Well, you've tiptoed there, unfortunately for you, into my hobby horse, which is about the gendered concepts of time and distraction, right? I think it's really interesting you talk about being distracted in the workplace. Arlie Russell Hochschild's great research from the 70s about chore alignment in households follows exactly what you were saying happens with you and your wife, which is also that men get schedulable tasks. So they clean out the garage or they mow the lawn, things that can be done at a time of their choosing. And women end up with stuff that can't be moved around, like the kids need their dinner, that they, you know, just has to be done at a specific time. Is there a kind of status thing? I mean, I always think about the fact of, you know, somebody who is sitting there in their corner office with a secretary is much less distractible because they've got fences and barriers up. Yeah, yeah. And is there a status aspect to who gets distracted and who is expected to give up their time and let themselves go off and do things for other people?
I think there is. And I certainly had my eyes opened to this. I wasn't cognizant of it. And I didn't really believe it until I dove into the research of how biased it is that even in dual income households, somehow women get stuck with an outsized share of the admin duties of the house. And that's just not fair. And so the only way to fix that problem is to talk about it, is to list out what do we all need to do, and then let's split that up appropriately as opposed to, again, the same problem that we see in corporations that we see in families. It's not the problem itself that's the problem. It's that we can't talk about the problem that is the problem.
Let's take some more questions. I've got one over here. And then anyone on this side of the room is much, I was going to say, is much more reluctant. So we'll get a mic over there as well. You're on the feisty side of the room, clearly. Philip here.
Very fascinating. I'm really enjoying this. But can you haven't mentioned computer games. Now, I know someone, it's not me, addicted, and a very academic person and, you know, really clever. But, you know, once they're doing it, That's it. They're completely distracted from everything else, and probably from the reasons that you gave, that everything else is emotionally difficult.
Yeah, so addiction, again, is this very loaded term that we need to be careful about how we apply it, because certainly there are some people who are addicted to technology, just as there are many products that are addictive and don't addict everyone, right? Many people who have a glass of wine with dinner are not alcoholics. Many people who play, you know, poker or blackjack once in a while, they're not all problem gamblers. Not everyone who has sex is a sex addict. So clearly we have this double standard when it comes to technology. If somebody likes something a lot, that does not make them addicted. An addiction is a pathology. And so we need to be very careful about this terminology. One, because I don't think it gives proper respect to the people who actually are suffering from this pathology and struggling with this disease. And two, I think by medicalizing this problem and making it sound like we're all addicted, what we're really teaching is learned helplessness. You know, we know that the number one determinant of whether someone will recover after rehab is their belief in their own power to change. And this is with physical dependencies. This study happened with alcoholics. And remember, we're not injecting Instagram. We're not freebasing Facebook here, right? These are behaviors. But if we believe that we are powerless, if we believe there is nothing we can do to stop, then of course it becomes true. We stop trying. So I think that's the first point. I think that we have to stop using this term to describe everyone. Some people do get addicted to products because to social media, to technology, to video games, but it's certainly not everyone. And I think that's a very important nuanced point, that some things can be addictive and not addict everyone. That addiction is much more complex than just the product. There are always other factors going on.
Can you, because you're talking hooked about the idea that you have to know what these techniques are and you can use them for good or evil. Can you give us some examples of ways, you know, things you do think are shady operations of this kind of technology and using distractions and using habit-forming technologies? Who are bad actors in this sphere?
So where we see it is with regret. Right, coercive tactics. So we call these dark patterns. There are many dark patterns. There's the bait and switch. There's the Roach Motel. There's privacy zuckering. There are all these dark patterns that companies have been caught using. The good news is that the vast majority of the time,
Tell me what the Roach Motel is.
I'll tell you exactly. Okay, I'll tell you what the Roach Motel is, but I'm not going to give you a tech example. I'm going to give you a low tech example.
Okay.
So I subscribed to a very popular print newspaper in the United States, which shall not be named, but it was the Wall Street Journal. And I wanted to cancel. After many years, I'd subscribed, but I just wasn't getting enough value from the paper. I just wanted the online edition. And it was extremely easy to sign up for a subscription. It took me seconds. They didn't even need my credit card. They just said, give us your address. You're a subscriber. We're going to send you. We'll bill you later. Don't worry about it. Very easy to get in, right? Just like a Roach Motel. The roaches come in. Roaches don't come out. I was the roach. So when I decided to cancel, I called the Wall Street Journal, and this has nothing to do with high-tech products, right? This is a print edition of a paper. I called the customer service line, which, by the way, was only open from 9 to 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. Eastern Standard Time. You can't call, only on weekdays. And when you call, this gentleman kept me on the phone, I'm not exaggerating, for an hour, checking with his supervisor, and what about this deal? What about this incentive? I was on the phone for an hour to cancel this stupid subscription. That's an example of a Roach Motel. And why does it fail the regret test? Because had I known that they used that tactic when I subscribed, I would have never subscribed. I regretted doing business with this company. Now, what's the moral of this story? That I'm telling you what happened. And this is what tends to happen with dark patterns. So as much as we complain about these companies and how the only solution is regulation, well, look, there was no regulation here. When you screw somebody, when you make them do something they didn't want to do, when you coerce them, not only will I never subscribe to the Wall Street Journal anymore, but I'm telling all of you what happened as well. And this is exactly what's happening with when companies tend to use these dark patterns. They become shamed. And there's actually a repository of these techniques. If you go to darkpattern.org, where you can see all these patterns, and the vast majority of them have been taken down.
The really interesting thing about that only works in a functional market where there are alternatives, right? You say, well, I'm not going to go to the Wall Street Journal. Actually, I had the same experience with the New York Times. You have to phone them. And eventually, I just had to let my debit card expire. That was the only way to get out of it. But But Facebook does a very similar thing. I now left Facebook, and on your way out, when it was shutting down your account, it shows you the faces of your friends and says, Steve will miss you. Are you sure you want to leave? Which, I, again, is one of those things where you kind of go, well, if I know they're going to do that to start with, that makes me feel a bit queasy. But there is no, I can't start, there's no mom and pop Facebook. Like, there's, it's a, because so many of these tech companies are dependent on network effects, are the only one in their sector. That is a, that is, anyway, this is a side point. But let's take the question over here. Did you get a mic? There you go.
One of the big advantages of, I mean, I hate technology, but one of the things I will say in favour of it is that tens of, maybe hundreds of thousands of people have survived, because mobile phones mean people get an ambulance quicker. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's not mentioned. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world have survived because of mobile phones.
Yeah. I think, you know, as much as we talk about the harm, back to your question earlier around what has it done for us and the harmful consequences, I think there's no more of a biased discussion than when it comes to the subject of kids and technology. I mean, we are bombarded by, well, how bad this is for our children and how it's causing an increase in suicide and all of these things that when you scratch below the surface, there's a lot more to the story. One, we know that when it comes to the use of technology by children, as long as that usage is age appropriate and the usage is 2 hours or less of age appropriate screen time, we see no negative consequences, right? No study has shown any negative consequences to moderate amounts of screen use. Where we do start seeing some negative effects is that with that really excessive use. And it's true that we have seen a rise in teen suicide, but only in the US and the UK. And we don't know why. It's not rising in the Nordic countries. It's not rising in Japan. It's not rising in any other OECD countries except the US and UK. And even in the US, it's only rising, not in urban centers, it's rising in the very in the rural settings. Trump country. We don't know why, but that's some of these facts. There's something going on. There's some kind of cancer that we're not addressing that's leading to this. Because, look, you know, the OECD, other OECD countries, Japan, the Nordic countries, have had cell phones for as long as we have. And I think another unintended, another under-discussed fact is that while we have seen this one metric of teen suicide rise since a historic low in 2014, by the way, teen suicide rates were about the same in the 1980s. They're not at historic highs. They're just at periodic highs from 2014, which was a historically low year. What we don't discuss is that all the things that used to kill kids are at record lows. Murder rates, record lows. Truancy, record lows. Drug use, record lows. Pregnancy, record lows. All of these things that kids used to do to get in trouble, so to speak, all of these things are at record lows. In my country, we have juvenile detention centers that are empty. This was supposed to be the generation of the super criminal, right? This was supposed to be this generation of kids who were going to be wild and you know, they built special prisons expecting this demographic boom of these super predators, and it never happened. We don't have the studies to say that for sure it's being caused by the tech use, but if we're going to blame technology for all the bad stuff it potentially does, the correlation perhaps with teen suicide, if we wanted to take a step back and say, look, all these bad aspects have decreased, maybe we should also look at our phones and ask ourselves, wait a minute, if you wanted to invent a device to keep kids safe at home, off the streets, maybe as an alternative to going outside and getting into trouble, maybe these games aren't quite so bad.
There is a maker of an app which is designed to lock you out of your phone during mealtimes, which is done for children. And he kind of came up with the idea and he said that to his kids. And they said, OK, Dad, but you have to use it too. And I think that's the really interesting thing. Sherry Turkle's book, Alone Together, begins with this insight of sitting at a baseball game and all the kids are chatting to each other and all the parents are on their phones. Because for children, the technology is just about connecting them with their school friends. They just want to constantly, in the way that my generation have been sitting on our one phone line, hogging it all night, right. They just want to spend time with their friends and the medium is less important to them. Whereas it's the parents who are face down in their important email that
it's
needs...
So true. You know, and children are hypocrisy detection devices. I mean, they are programmed. We cannot tell our children, get off Fortnite while we're checking email. We have to show them what it means to be indistractable.
Well, that is on that very good and upbeat note, I'm going to say thank you. Niall will be with us afterwards to sign books, so afterwards, so do check those, please, out. And also, if you'd like to check out more about the RSA, please have a look at the website. There's a series, ongoing series of talks, but it's been a fascinating talk, so big hand, please, for Niall.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.